order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood. From my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path to omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect.
O Manjushri, please accomplish this.
Hey, good evening. So this is like really auspicious to be back in this room where we began 15 years ago. Who was in that class? Madhyamakavatara, Introduction to the Middle Way. Right. Peter was too, yes. Cynthia, Peter.
There was 44 people in that
There were 44, you remember that number. Yeah. It was huge. It was amazing.
It took 3 years.
2.5 years. Five 12-week classes to go through the text. Using Tsongkhapa Rinpoche's commentary and Mipham's commentary, both of them. That was great.
Yeah.
It's a learning experience. So we're back here in this cool room. It's a little bit formal, like being in here. Doesn't it feel like more formal? It's like people are further away or something. Or it's not as cozy. Can you guys hear okay in the back? What about the yellow? That's not the right yellow. How did they paint that yellow? Mustard in the back doors? That's really odd.
No.
Yeah, let's not do that again.
No.
We've been through that, right?
For about 2 years.
They ran out of gold and it was all they had. Goldish. Goldfish. So cool. Tonight we continue with the Mahamudra. Really profound and deep material. I think we had a homework assignment. What was the homework assignment? Over the Thanksgiving vacation, while you're eating all that turkey, maybe I forgot to give the homework.
Be mindful of it or something?
Be mindful. No, to look at your mind, find your mind. See if you can find your mind.
If you can find the turkey.
Yeah, right. Did anybody look at their minds? No?
Couldn't find it.
That's what everybody says at first, but
have you found yours?
Yes.
What color?
You know, my mind doesn't really have a color. It's sort of opaque. Maybe it has like a tinge of yellow.
What shape?
You know, I can't tell you that right away. It's a little bit.
Is it the stuffing, or is it different?
It's a little bit personal. It's different from the stuffing.
And where is it located?
Well, that's very personal.
Is the stuffing in the center or on the side?
The stuffing's on the side.
Thank God.
But, like, have you done this? Have you looked for your mind? And what do you find?
It's there.
It's there, right? Mm-hmm. See, the wrong answer is to say, oh, they say that there is no mind. Of course the mind doesn't exist and you can't find it. That's the wrong answer. They give you the wrong answer to try to mislead you. You have to know that. You have to understand that you actually are supposed to find a fact. It's obviously not your mind, right? That's the secret, is that obviously you can't see your mind because your mind is what?
Transparent and
invisible.
It's not material, right? It's mind. So
but
it has.
In the text, he calls it out and says that mind is like space. Like he's actually kind of. He says mind is permanent and unchanging. Point blank says it. But then he also kind of talks about his mind changing all the time. You know, like the different effects of it. So I found it a little. I actually found what you mean by confusing it so much.
Yeah.
Or at least. Like,
good. Good.
It
It's like you're taking it. Yeah, you. That's great when that happens. You read the same thing over and over, and then finally it's like, wait a second, what the hell are they talking about? That doesn't make sense. There was a... at one point he says, don't worry if what you experience sounds a bit silly. That's the most important line.
Where is that?
That's on 172, but we're not there yet. That's skipping ahead.
But basically,
yeah. Did they really use that term? Excellent.
Say it again.
Highfalutin dharma
charities. Highfalutin dharma. Yeah. Yeah. How do they spell falutin?
With no G, just highfalutin. F A L U T I N or something like that.
I love that.
There's that, and I'm like, all the talk about the radio thing.
Obviously, they didn't have radios. Yeah, somebody took some liberties, huh? I should ask the translator.
I was sure I was reading that. I had to like check the syllabus.
Yeah, see who wrote this.
Any other places it's been like academic or like from books instead of high quality? Like you get a sense.
Oh, I see. So this, yeah, that's
like,
right.
It sounds like you're getting it straight from the text.
Right. Instead of highfalutin. Okay, good. So, as Peter said, I think we just finished the first point. Is that right?
What page?
161. Does that sound vaguely correct?
The posture.
We went through the posture, is that right? Should we do that again? Or? You all have perfect posture now, right? Hey, you, straighten up.
No, they forgot the whole thing about the knees being under the hip bones.
Yeah, they don't ever say that. It's like that's they like so assume it. You know, I think that's because in Asia they basically grow up sitting on the floor and their thighs are open already, and so their knees are lower than their hips. It's just
that's
resting.
Really awesome.
It's essential.
It's essential, right?
That your knees are lower than your hips.
Have to be always.
And there's a tendency often for people to push their pelvis forward slightly, to arch the back slightly. That's incorrect. You need to tilt the pelvis back. Is that okay? A little bit so that it's straight. And then you straighten up from there, push up from there. And opening the shoulders, really important, opening the shoulders. And it's helpful to like first let the arms flop by the side so you find what actually neutral place is with your shoulders. So your shoulders are open. Bless you, sort of. And then you bend your elbows, and then you place your hands down without your shoulders coming forward. And if you do it that way, just bend the elbows and then place them down. Chin down a little bit. You know, and then your hands will go forward a little bit more. That's natural. But over time, they tend to creep forward too much. If they're, you know, like on your knees, that's usually not correct. Some people do have longer than usual arms. Okay. We'll measure them later. And chin down slightly. Gaze. Does he? It's a little vague on the gaze, right?
Straight
ahead in the direction of your nose.
And then in the
posture of the direction of the skull. But we're in shamatha for beginner now. So pick a point that's in front of you, you know, diagonally down. If you're on a cushion, like 6 feet in front. On a chair, it's like 8, maybe 10. And then connect with the periphery of your gaze. Connect with the edges of your gaze all around. So you start with the point and then you feel the periphery. And then you come back and you relax into the middle of space. Whatever the midst of the distance is and the periphery and you. So you sort of triangulate and you find this magical point in space where there's no object to look at, but you just rest your eyes and you diffuse. And then you see the whole visual field. Equally, without looking at any particular thing. Sort of like you're daydreaming. So you straightened way up, like push, exaggerate, and then release, then relax a little bit. And then with the breath, finding the feeling the breath in the body, low down breathing. Three places you can breathe in your chest and your shoulders move. That's the way a lot of us breathe during the day. Short, little, shallow breaths, that's not good. So at least breathe down through your abdomen. So the underneath your rib cage is moving. But the best is to breathe down below the lower belly. And to literally gently push the air down into that area. So starting off by feeling the full breath, feeling it all the way down, pushing it down, and then feeling it come back up and out. And then bring the attention to where the air enters and leaves, the mouth, the nose, just that area. So you're focused in that area, both in and out breath. Eyes still diffused. Gently breathing, no manipulation, but trying to manipulate it down into the lower belly. A little bit. And then extend the out breath, emphasize the out breath, feel that, have that sense of letting go. And then just relax on the in breath, let go. Gap, don't do anything. Open up, feel the space in the room, light, hear the sounds. Come back to your posture. Feel your posture, feel the body, the sense of the heaviness of the body, the sensation of touch in the body, and then the next out breath. So each of the three parts of the technique, body, breath, and mind, has three parts to it. So the body had first, you relax down, you settle down, relax, become really heavy in the cushion, wobble around, find your spot. Then you straighten way up, over to the extreme, and then you relax into the middle. Then the breath, following the full breath, down on the lower belly, and then focusing them where it enters and leaves, the nose or the nose and the mouth, is the second step, and then releasing the in-breath. And then being precise on the out-breath, feeling that sense of going out, into space, opening up on the in-breath, just letting go, no object. Feel the space, come back to the posture. And the next out-breath. And similarly for mind, recognizing thought, noticing when there is thought, identifying thought is the key. In practice, seeing that one way or another your mind is basically thinking all the time, even if it feels like it's settled, it's thinking. It's thinking seeing, or it's thinking hearing, or it's thinking feeling. So whenever it becomes discrete, meeting that thought, recognizing it, labeling it internally with thinking, and then letting go. And coming back to wherever you are in the cycle. And then for very advanced meditators like all of you, gradually you loosen up on the technique, and the labeling dissolves, and you notice thoughts as they arise more, and you don't leave the watcher as thoughts are happening. So there's less of a distinction between getting lost in thoughts and not being lost in thoughts, because you're always here, present, and you lose coarse focus on the breath, and there's just this sense of breathing happening, and overall there's more sense of feeling the space, the container, the environment, light, sound, and most of all the sense of presence in the body. Sense of watchfulness that resides in the body. The sense of touch, slight vibration of the tactile sense in the body that pervades the body. And that provides the basis for experience and vividness and clarity in the meditation. As thoughts quiet down, you experience calmness, but it leads to dullness. And so the breath and the sensation of touch help you experience vividness, clarity. Vividness is the intensity of sense perception or thoughts of whatever hits your mind is seen precisely, is experienced fully without a filter of discursive thought. And there's clarity of just knowing, all the time just knowing that you're here, knowing that you're meditating. And gradually progressing thereby through the different powers which map out the stages of shamatha, initially figuring out the technique. Learning the technique is hearing and contemplating, or learning and contemplating. And then actually entering into the practice is mindfulness, focused attention, initially focused very precisely on the breath and thoughts, and gradually shifting, expanding, sense of expansion to watchfulness, the second of the three main qualities of shamatha. But in terms of the six powers, it's the fourth power. The first is learning, second is contemplation, the third is mindfulness, and the fourth is watchfulness, vigilance, introspection, sheshin. So really for us, the meaningful ones are the third, mindfulness, focused attention, and then the fourth, watchfulness. And when the watchfulness tends to become sort of too relaxed, too expanded outward, you need to come back and experience the vividness and the intensity of perception. And that's the source of energy, the fifth power, exertion. Actually applying the antidote of being present. And then lastly, equanimity, having all the different qualities in unison. Precise, watchful, energized, and relaxed and stable, calm and deep like an ocean. Stable like a mountain, calm and peaceful like an ocean. So Rinpoche gives the three analogies of the body is like a mountain, immovable. The speech is disconnected, like a stringed instrument where the string has been broken. And there's just a vibration left in space. And the mind is like a placid lake. Deep, reflective, clearly reflective of whatever passes in front of it. Okay, sorry about that. So we're on page 161, focusing on a visual object. I thought maybe, yeah, I think so. Yeah. So maybe it makes sense to do a little. Meditation here and there, since this is a course on meditation. If you're unable to settle your mind in this state, you should focus by looking at an external object, such as a stick, a pebble, a Buddha statue, a flame, a butter lamp, the sky, and so forth. Whatever suits you. So they use this system of a progression of different objects, whereas we use one focal object, the breath, basically. Although the posture is really another focal object, and the thoughts are also, but we say the breath is the main focal object. We don't go through all these different versions that the tradition does. It's good for us just to take one technique and stick with it, and use that technique to go through the different stages of the practice that the different objects that they use take one through, which begins with a very focused, an emphasis on focused attention, concentration, with a visual object, and then gradually opens up in the way I just described. So we go through the same, they go through that same process by switching objects. We basically don't really talk about how we switch objects, but we subtly do switch objects. Initially it's the breath, and gradually we're meditating on our mind. As we go into a more open, spacious, we're basically then meditating on our mind. Don't think about such things as the color or shape of the object, which is the basis of your meditation. Rather, place your attention single-mindedly without any wandering and merely the object itself, and abandon having your mind being either too tight or too sloppy. Cut off completely any extraneous train of thought. So, not the color or shape, but just the entity of the object. It's an interesting description. If your mind is too tense, you'll be anxious and frustrated. If too loose, fogginess, foggy-mindedness, dullness, sleepiness. So your mind should be tuned just right without any distortion, like the strings of a flute. The process of settling the mind on this visual object is like trying to see a stone on the bottom of a glass of muddy, turbulent water. Without worrying about the color or shape of the stone, you will see it clearly when the mud subsides. Likewise, when your thoughts subside, you will be left with a clear view of your mind. Your object. Therefore, look at objects as a small child would, without any mental chatter or commentary. I guess this is Tibetan children. If you can focus without any conceptual thoughts or ideas, that's great. But should they arise, don't follow them out. Just let them pass and they will disappear. If you allow thought to grow into a train of thought, it will be an obstacle. So you must realize that thoughts are just the play of the mind, like ripples on water, light on leaves, and they will naturally dissolve. So the technique of the labeling is not a common, openly discussed technique in these texts in the tradition. It's something that Trungpa Rinpoche seems to have developed on his own. You can also focus in front of you either on a written or visualized white syllable om and so forth, or on dots, whatever suits you. In short, you should aim and fix your mind single-pointedly to whatever type of visual form suits it and gives it pleasure to hold it there. If you try to sell your mind on something that it finds uncomfortable or which you cannot grasp, then when you try to make it go to this object, your mind will ignore it. Having no interest, it will fix on something extraneous, something easier to fix upon. You should cut off completely all signs of thought, such as thinking, I'm meditating, or I'm not meditating, or expectations to settle your mind, such as, why won't it, my mind be calm, or worries that you'll be unable to do it. Meditate, having your mindfulness keep a check, not to let your mind fix for even an instant on something extraneous, which it should not be meditating on at all. Do this well and let your meditations be short and frequent. It's important for your training, for training your mind to settle single-pointedly with continuing clarity, lucidity, and eagerness so that it will not repeatedly lose the continuity of this state because of becoming tired. Traditionally, like a short session is somehow they come up with this span of 24 minutes. It's like their magic number. And it's if you divide the number of minutes in a day by 60, you come up with 24. So if you divide the number of minutes by 24, you come up with 60, it's an hour. And if you do it the other way, if you divide the number of minutes by 60, you come up with 24. So they say there's 60 24 minute cycles in a day. So they use 24 as like, it's the magic golden number for like a short, clear session. And they like at the beginning, not having extended sessions until you're stable, but then definitely do extend them. So if you do like a little retreat on your own, try that. Do like multiple sessions of 24, 30 minutes, you know, and then do something else, walk, meditation, or maybe read, or go on the computer and use, you know, your phone, and check your, you know, but then come back and do other, you know, just do like repeated sessions. It's really, really helpful experience. Anyway, at first it's important to have short but frequent. If you find the meditation blissful and soothing, you may pursue it for a longer period of time. However, if you begin to become depressed or bored while meditating, perhaps your sessions are too long. If you're tired, this part is funny. It's like you don't want to have a bad experience because then you're not going to come back. Right?
This is interesting because that's definitely not what we did.
No, Rinpoche was totally the opposite, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So that was not really like Mahamudra Shamatha. That was like boot camp Shamatha. Like, you know, just sit and irritate yourself as much as possible and bore yourself as much as possible. So really, hopefully we've, you know, so the short sessions really doesn't, following his lead, is not appropriate for a beginner. For beginners, you want to have them experience irritation and get past that beginner's luck, you know, where people are like, oh, that was great. My mind, oh, that's so easy. Not many people have that, though. But you want to get people to the point of, like, where they become exhausted with their mind, right? And then the short sessions make sense. I don't know. Teachers have different techniques.
Now we sort of start with the idea that short is okay, you know, built up. And it, I mean, it seems like it's not bad to have people have some degree of positive experience. And then as they get more committed, then they can, then you really stretch it out, and then you get into all of the boredom and everything else.
That is the traditional version, yeah.
Actually, the experience is that when you do the what you might call irritation meditation, you do have a lot of short sessions. I mean, you're irritated and you recognize it, and then for a moment you're not, and then you're irritated. And
you set your own timing.
And then for a moment you're not. So, you know, and then the irritation comes back quite as strong.
Well, are you saying that in this schema that they would start with the short, but then they would eventually stretch it out more?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he says it, but yes, definitely. Gauge yourself, take a break while you're still fresh and wish to continue. That way you'll be happy to resume your meditation. Skipping, let's see, if it's comfortable for your mind to take any one of these objects, you should choose that one. If you wish to take each of them in turn, that's permitted. But if you've taken one and you find it sufficient, don't feel you need to take all of them, as if you're going through the alphabet. In short, having your mind hold whatever visual form suits it is the second point. So it goes through a number of points. The third is outer sensory objects. Once you've held such a visual object, then the progressive order you should take as your object for concentration is sound, as the object of your ear's consciousness, a smell, the object of your nose, a taste, a tactile sensation, and so forth.
This is all awareness, it seems like.
I'm sorry?
This is all awareness.
Well, he's not really distinguishing. He's at this point, they're saying start with mindfulness, and then we'll see what he says about awareness. He hasn't really mentioned that distinction.
They're not really using either of those terms, are
they? Yeah, he hasn't. For this, as far as sounds and so forth go, you should direct your mind at merely an outstanding sound or strong odor, and hold it with the hook of your mindfulness, not letting your mind wander astray. except for letting your mind settle to its own level. You should not make any judgments whatsoever about the quality, quantity, and so forth. So whatever situation you happen to be in, use it to help develop mental quiescence. If where you're meditating it's noisy or somebody's playing the freedom. Focus on the pure audio sensation of it without judgments, reactions, or identification of the sound. For touch, focus on the feeling of your clothing next to your skin. It's not necessary to eat something during meditation in order to focus on tastes. You can do this while you're taking your meals. Simply remain detached and follow the instructions as before. When your mind has been holding whatever it has, you should break your session while you still have full clarity and then take a rest. This way, God forbid, you should become bored. In between sessions, don't let the rope of mindfulness break. As for how to look, you should be directed on what is in front of your nose. Just general instructions for like practitioners in retreat or monks is that you don't like, you know, look around a lot. It's like you have the gaze of an elephant sort of idea. As to your body and speech, whether you're walking or sitting, talking or speaking, do these neither too strongly nor too much. So you're being mindful as you speak and you're thinking about what you're saying. As for your mind, try to cut the stream of conceptual thoughts and chatter, the inner dialogue, subconscious dialogue. By stages, you will thereby build up the habit of single-mindedness. This is the third point. If you lessen your activities, it will help. If you're constantly busy, it's more difficult to focus. Point four, eliminating mental dullness and agitation. To eliminate these faults, you should visualize at the middle of your brow a dot, the size of a pea. So in the Mahamudra and Vajrayana traditions, they give all these Vajrayana type visualizations for as remedies for dullness and agitation. And we usually don't recommend those, but you can always try. But remember that if you try lots of different things, none of them really work that well. You know, so always try to do one thing. Let's see, direct your mind towards it. Sometimes direct your mind towards a black dot at the point in front of where your folded legs touch your seat. For mental dullness, direct your attention to the white one and your way of looking should be as if into space. So this idea that if you're dull, you raise your gaze. You're looking upward to white, to light, to brightness. If you're agitated, you're looking downward. You bring in your senses closer in and you're using darker colors or images to try to rein in your agitated mind. Then also, as for activities, keep warm, do exercise, get lots of sleep, and eat heavy, nutritious food. And always brush your teeth. Mental dullness and agitation are the greatest obstacles to shamatha. With dullness, your mind either has no clarity, or if it does, you're in a daze. To perk yourself up, I'm sorry?
Why do you eat this food? Because when I did that tonight, I would chow down my face at lunch and then sleep the afternoon.
Good, that's like a bear, right?
So,
that's traditional, right? Is to fall asleep after lunch at Dhatan.
Oh, okay.
To perk yourself up. Visualize a white dot in your brow and thus bend your mind upwards. Let's see. You can also put a white cloth in front of your eyes. White color being the image in your mind awakens you a little and your mind naturally becomes brighter. Or you can like see sunlight artificial light, cool and breezy. Diet is important. Light food makes the mind light. Yeah. You do your first dhatan and you're like, eating has other purposes, right? With agitation, on the other hand, you're overexcited and your mind cannot stay where you wish to place it. Even if it maintains a hold on the object, part of it starts to wander astray. That's an interesting experience, feeling like your mind is in different places, right? So you visualize a black dot underneath you. Bend the mind downwards and the somber color naturally makes your mind more subdued. If you're very fidgety, physical exercise will tire you and cause your mind to wander less. Much agitation is due to the energy winds being too light and active, therefore heavy. Fatty diet will weigh down these winds and make you less flighty if you're flighty. You can also do like little exercises between sessions, which isn't a bad idea anyway, to do some exercise. Thus, for a properly balanced meditation, it's important to look after your body. The mind rides in the energy winds through the energy channels of your subtle body. For those to flow properly, it depends on the condition of your rough physical body. Therefore, a sound body and mind are interdependent. That's why all lamas are very fit. That's why all lamas are very fit. Right? If you have neither mental dullness or agitation, direct your eyes and mind to either a small blue dot or an actual small blue object on the ground at the distance in front of you at the end of your shadow. Your shadow depends on your direction that you are in relation to the sun, but about an arrow's length away. With respect to these, first you should think, the dot and so forth I'm supposed to meditate on is like this, and then you should simply project your mind out to it. If after this the object is clear, that's great. If it's not clear, you should merely think that there's an object like this and then make that the focus of your attention. Then, without making any analysis or minute inquiry, let your mind reach its level and naturally settle on it without wandering. The blue of a clear, dustless autumn sky is a neutral color that neither uplifts nor subdues the mind. It's beneficial to have both mental placement and clarity with respect to this dot, but if you have only placement, this is enough. So placement meaning concentrated focus, not necessarily imbued with clarity. With sufficient concentration, then clarity will come automatically. When you still have full clarity, break your session, then continue meditating later. In other words, have short and frequent sessions. So they mention the blue of a sky. You can also try meditating on the sky, if you can find it. Focusing on no object. As for directing your mind on the basis of on no basis or object, stare blankly into space straight in front of you with open eyes and not direct your mind to any object. Space, like the nature of the mind, is a permanent, unconditioned, not dependent phenomenon, not dependent on causes and circumstances. It's a generally characterized phenomenon. Staring at the space before you is a method of, or approach for meditation on the mind itself. Meditation on no object should not be confused with blank-mindedness, in which you're completely dull as if in a stupor or faint. It is extremely alert, mindful, and clear. But as in the clear light death meditations without any object or thoughts, you know those, right, meditation. You remember when you died, right? Without letting your mind think about anything, don't allow even the slightest mental wandering. Don't direct your mind to thoughts of what qualities the state has or does not have, or the past or the future. Nail your mindfulness as a spy to check with great diligence that you don't wander astray, and then relax. In other words, place yourself in a tranquil, uncontrived state of being here and now. Don't wander for an instant. Be as if you're threading a needle. I like that image. Particularly guys trying to thread a needle. Do you move the needle to the thread or? Never mind. Don't let your mind be turbulent. Rather, have it be like an ocean without any waves. Don't self-consciously try to do anything. Just fix your mind like an eagle soaring.
It seems inconsistent to say, don't let it wander,
but
don't have any thoughts.
Right.
And then it just says, don't self-consciously try to accomplish anything.
Yeah. I think they mean anything else.
Very heavy instructions.
Yeah. In what sense? Say more. But do this. But don't do it as if you're doing it. It would be nice if they would like acknowledge that they're being a little contradictory in that way and point that out, that they're saying, like, in order to not do anything, you have to do it very precisely.
It's hard not to do anything.
It's very hard not to do anything. Being Buddhist.
Yeah.
There you go.
What was that?
being contradictory is sort of synonymous with being Buddhist. let's see. When you have no mental wandering, thoughts won't come. When mental wandering occurs, then because your thoughts will come one after another, try to recognize them for what they are as soon as they arise. In other words, stare right at them and fix your mind as before on them. No matter what thoughts arise, just recognize them as thoughts. Place your attention right on them without thinking anything like, this is a good one or a bad one, or I must not think. Just look at them with the eye of discriminating awareness. Take the thought itself as the basis or object for your mind to hold and then fix upon it. Train your mind not to fall into either too tense or too loose. When you begin to meditate, it may seem like your thoughts are increasing. This is not so. You're merely...
A question?
Sure.
Do you take this last paragraph of what happens when thoughts occur as something like the instruction of touch and go?
That's good. That's neat. I think so.
I like that this is...
Yeah, I like that.
I'm touch and go always perplexed me, I think, when I first, because it's given to you very early in your training. And like it just, I never quite knew how to, like, I don't know, I think I just wrestled it like a bear for years.
But isn't labeling touch and go? Like the touch is labeling?
I feel like touch and go was a more sophisticated instruction than label, because labeling I felt like I could do because it was very mechanical.
But to touch is like, once you recognize the thought, you touch it by labeling it. You put the label on it, and then you let go.
You skip the label,
then
you label it.
No, you skip the label.
Isn't it
like the instruction, like when like something,
this is great, we all have different interpretations of it.
That's also the notion that you don't want to push away, so that you do want to make some contact.
Yeah.
You want to touch it. You want to touch it. I
want to
touch it.
Like if bad things happen, your quote unquote bad things happen, distracting things happen in your meditation or your mind,
it's like,
you don't ignore them.
Yeah.
And this kind of has that feeling. I think touch and go finally, I came to something like you can't just ignore that distraction.
Yeah, you got to relate to it, right?
Like
in order to.
That you're ignoring.
Yeah, it's repressing it otherwise, right?
And I felt that same kind of feel spelled out in this paragraph, I think it's all.
Yeah, like stare right at them.
Look at it, engage.
It's like if you're a little kid, all you want to do is like touch all the candy in the store, right? And if your mom won't let you do that, you're going to obsess about that, right? And you're going to think that's what I want to do. But if they let you do that, you know, rummage through and then you pick one. And then, you know, moment for a moment, you let go.
Well, it's part of the paradox, or the, like, it says, don't get distracted for even a second. But then it says, but if you do get distracted, don't run away from it. Like, look at it. Which is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, normally, like, when thoughts come up, it bothers us.
Contradiction.
Normally, when thoughts come up, it, like, bothers us, and it's like there's us and the thought. And instead, like, engulf, as Rinpoche said, engulf the thoughts by touching them, hug them, and then let them go.
It's recognized.
Recognized.
Which takes some sort of conceptual.
Yeah, so for you, touch is recognized, right? And what's letting go?
Labeling.
It's just a moment of recognition and then letting it, let that recognition.
We all have a different version.
Stop. The recognition happens automatically and naturally, and then the non-recognition, I'm like, I'm bored with that, I already know what that is.
Can we all agree that at some point you let them go?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go. Let's go on from there.
We recognize them.
Yeah, we all agree that you recognize them.
We recognize that we recognize.
Let's see. The mind and the thoughts are neither the same, they're different than if they were. One, there would be no way to quiet or eliminate them. That's interesting. If they were different, you can have thoughts without a mind. Thoughts are the temporary play of the mind. The mind is clear and pure without any specific qualities, like a mirror. Thoughts are the images on that mirror. They cannot be separated from it, nor are they the same as it. That's helpful to remember for later on. Thoughts are the results. Yes. Thoughts are the result of confusion about the true nature of reality, and there are many different kinds. A little understatement. Coarse or rough thoughts are easy to identify. If you meditate on a cup, wanting to drink, and then call someone to fetch it to you, hey, that's coarse. A subtle thought would be thinking, this is a cup, it's made of paper mache, or identifying the sound of an iPhone. Why don't we just change, you know, update it totally to focus on the cup. But whatever type of thought arises, identify it, recognize it's merely a thought, the play of the mind, like an image in the mirror, and let it go. Have your thoughts continually dissolve like a parade of characters marching across the stage without any ever standing still. If you think that a little thought doesn't matter, that's a poor attitude. Forest fires grow from a small flame. Likewise, from the small thought, this is a teacup you dwell on, you will soon be in the kitchen brewing tea, having completely discarded your meditation. None of us ever done that. Just look at the thought without following out and naturally resolve. Nothing else it can do. Focusing on the breath and the three stages of settling is a method to hold the mind. You can direct it on the breath as its basis or object. Hold your breath with Vaz breathing practice and fix your mind single-pointedly on it without any mental wandering. If you cannot hold your breath in the Vaz breath manner, you should take as your object such things as the counting of your breath. Count your inhalation, exhalation, and holding. So the counting practice. So, you know, this is what I was talking about earlier when I said there's a lot of different little techniques introduced. So in our tradition, we don't do all those other techniques. We just do one continuous technique that goes through a progression. You know, so I presented at the beginning, I presented some progression of first, you know, breathing down into the lower belly, which is really very similar to Vaz breathing, just bringing the air down into the lower belly. And then feeling the whole breath in and out, and then bringing it in and out where it enters and leaves, and then letting go of the out breath. A similar progression that they present in a much more solid, discreet way. Let's see, but if you can hold your breath while your body is filled with air and then release it with the Vaz breathing, you should first expel all the air. They do most traditions, they do this thing of expelling the breath with the three or the nine breaths. We don't really do that except until you get to certain Vajrayana practices. Force it down beneath the navel, and when you can no longer hold it, release it and exhale. So this is forceful, a little bit more forceful Vaz breathing compared to what I was recommending. Just trying to breathe down low really helps you settle and stabilize your body and mind initially. Focusing on the breath is an effective way to settle the mind. The mind rides on the energy, winds, or breaths. Therefore, if there's much turbulent breathing, there are many disturbing thoughts, and vice versa. There are several types of breathing. Even or normal breathing is the type you have with neither sick nor excited. Intermediate is when you inhale and slightly hold it. Vaz breathing is when you inhale, contract your sphincter muscle, which is located in your ass. And what's the technical word for your ass? The proper term. But okay. Isn't there like a anatomical word? Your anus, thank you. And hold your upper and lower breaths together. So you're pushing down the lower breath and bringing up the lower muscles. Vaz breathing is very advanced and potentially dangerous practice. So be careful. Don't get like really into this thinking, oh, this is like this really cool stuff. I got to do this and I'm going to do it really extremely. You know, so it actually can be dangerous. Your guru normally will teach it to you only after you've completed the Nundro practices. Anybody here complete Nundro practice? Okay, so no Vaz breathing. Let's see, you can throw your energy system into imbalance, causing nervousness, frustration of energy, and excessive emailing.
The base of the spine, by the way.
I'm sorry?
The base of the spine?
I can't tell you, man. If mental darkness, dullness, or agitation occur, every effort, exert effort and meditate in the methods to eliminate them in stages. If you can't settle your mind on any of these types of objects, then take any other kind of object, to whatever works. Personality types are not all the same. Some people hear the teachings just two or three times and are able to develop a settling of their mind. Some are unable to develop this even though they meditate for many, many, many years. I like the way he says they hear it just two or three times. He doesn't say just once. It's like the best is like two or three times, right? If you nourish it and do not give up out of slothfulness or depression, it's impossible for you not to develop it, but it is necessary to have an experienced guru. Thank you, Nawar, to dispel your problems, induce your success, inspire you, and so forth. Nourishing your meditation this way, you'll pass through three stages of settling your mind. First, so he summarizes the traditional, like five stages that we use for this scheme into three. Steep mountain, waterfall, thoughts are coarse and many. On the second, your coarse thoughts set like the sun. Although occasionally some thoughts will suddenly occur, you recognize them, what they are, and as soon as you do, they subside. The stream of your meditation flows on gently and steadily like a mighty river, like the mighty Hudson. Finally, all of your thoughts, coarse and subtle, set, and you settle in equipoise in a non-conceptual state. This third stage is also referred to as the river having merged into the ocean, or the child reuniting with her mother after a long separation. You see this in Vajrayana texts sometimes. They say mother and child meeting, the meeting of mother and child.
Are they
from nyams? Rinpoche calls it the nyams. And nyams, N-Y-A-M-S, temporary experiences. And he when he goes through the four foundations in the 73 seminary, he says there's two sets of noms. Mm. There's ones like emptiness, bliss, and non-thought or something. And then there's these five stages. Most people don't call these stages, he said there's three stages, Kongshol lists five stages. Most people don't call those stages nyams. They just say these are the experiences you go through in the meditation practice. For some reason, Rinpoche calls them nyams. I've never seen anyone else.
I mean, it's just based on, is that actually the translation of the word experience?
It might be. Yeah, maybe
so
that's why.
It's
just like these are
thing,
different experiences.
But the ones that people typically call nyams with the capital, so to speak, are the ones that come later.
Yeah, and then Judy actually in the Profound Treasury, she gathered from other talks a set of like very early on experiences that she has in the early section of the shamatha section, where it's just like aches and pains and your eyes shifting and eye strain or like constriction where you're breathing, you know, like really early on people have sometimes these little odd experiences in meditation. Let's see. All turbulence and uneasiness has been settled and murkiness still, and you're in a perfect, pristine state. Can't wait. Because it's possible to have such a settling in the mind into a non-conceptual state of bliss and clarity in which your mind is in equipoise, alert, vivid, pristine, and pure. You should enhance your enthusiastic perseverance until you attain such an experience. Even after you reach this state, you must practice so that its continuity will not be broken. Eliminating tightness and looseness. If you've not reached this third stage of settling the mind, you must actively work with your mind in order to achieve it. You must further enhance your enthusiastic perseverance, zeal, ardor, right? That quality, ardor, that the Buddha talks about in the Satipatthana. This you should do through the three techniques of tightening your mental grip, relaxing it, and meditating while being turned away from both these necessities. So using this idea of like, let's tighten up, get really tight in the practice, and then okay, let's loosen up. And then just like letting go of doing anything. And as an interesting way to work with mental agitation and a sort. Well, he says tightness and looseness, which is actually different than agitation and laxity. Tightness and looseness is like where you're over, tightness is you're over applying the technique, you're being too literal. And looseness is where you're just like, oh, whatever goes, and you spend the time just drifting in meditation.
Actually, aren't they also, in this case, talking about tightening and loosening as positive things rather than what you're describing as being like too much? These are more like...
Well, the title is eliminating them. So the title of the section is eliminating them. But this, the three techniques are tightening, you know, like so... if you are too tight or too loose, exaggerate it in a very short, intentional spurt. As for tightening your mental grip, if it's too loose, you should sit in the body position, look in the way, in the proper way, and take control of your cognition.
It's weird because, as you say, the title says eliminating, but it's actually telling you to do it, which is a traditional thing too.
This is true, to eliminate something by doing it. In other words, tighten up your discipline. Don't let your mind wander. Be as if walking across a single planked bridge. Draw your mind tight, perk it up so it's vibrant like a bell, but without thinking. This is the object I should be meditating on. Don't let your mind wander for a moment and make your meditation sessions short and frequent. For relaxing, do exercises, physical exercises to exhaust your body and work out that mental agitation, and then sit looking again in the proper way. If you're tense, nervous, or over-agitated, prostration and circumambulation of religious sites are excellent things to do. Excellent activities. This is a beneficial way to harness energy, use your excess energy and accumulate merit. Afterwards, when you're physically tired and sick, back down, your body as well as your mind as well as your body will relax and have less disturbance.
Would you say that those physical activities that you're doing are more for the purpose of eliminating sort of body excess energy, or for the devotional purposes that they are?
Here it's the former. Uh-huh. Don't direct your mind at any object. So here we go to the next stage. Don't direct your mind at any object. Rather, let your mind relax itself and loose down into a natural state, uncontrived, unselfconsciously conscious, not anxiously caring about anything. Just place it on whatever comes up. Let it become tranquil and relaxed, and it will reach its own level in equipoise. Don't try to accomplish anything or exert yourself. Relax like a baby with a full stomach. So this is after you eliminate mental tightness and looseness, you don't need to then do anything further. You don't need to continue to apply those antidotes. Relax like a baby with a full stomach or a pile of straw when the rope tying it has been cut. Then fix your mind and have your mindfulness be in the ever-present moment so that you do not wander at all from that state. Except for this, there's nothing to meditate upon. Just place your mind in its natural state, and if your sessions are short, lengthen them slightly. Settle in a resplendent state of mind, and if it dissolves, take a rest. Even in between sessions, have your mindfulness. Keep a careful check. When meditating while turned away from the necessity either to tighten or relax, there will be times when you have no mental wandering and thoughts will not come. But when your mind wanders or thoughts arise, if you try to get rid of them, you will not be able to. Just look right at them and kindly and think, wherever you're going, please go there. And thus you will intrude and sever the train of their going. You know, so saying something silly like that to yourself, then one more will arise in a second. Recognize them. Don't even try to get rid of or abandon them. Don't try to follow them out. Don't be happy if your mind is settled or unhappy if it's running. Don't worry that your meditation is not happening or working, or have high hopes that it will be good. Without any expectations or worries, have your mind take hold of the thought itself as the basis. Expectation is one of the hardest things to overcome in meditation practice. Hoping for like some experience or some accomplishment. You will never be able to reach a non-conceptual state by blocking conceptual thoughts. This is a really key statement. Take these very thoughts themselves as your object and focus right on them. Conceptual thoughts dissolve by themselves when you do that. When they clear away, then a non-conceptual state will dawn. Therefore, practice like that. Next is the way to develop the actual state of mental quiescence and recognize its nature. Mental quiescence is a state in which your mind is quieted of all mental wandering. It's a placement of the mind in single-pointed concentration on the non-conceptual nature of things and is free of dullness, agitation, and fogginess. Previously, this has been attained with effort, but now it does not require any effort. It comes about easily and is blissful, expansively roomy, and flexibly fluid. Even when you rise from meditation, your mind does not alter at all. No matter where it goes, it always comes back and rests in this very state. Just like a pigeon released from a boat in mid-ocean can do nothing but return to its ship. There's nowhere else to go. Your mind, no matter how much activity it has, can only return to its settled state once you have accomplished this stage of mental quiescence or shamatha. When you're walking, sitting, whatever, your cognitions are at a leisurely pace. Your mind is stable, relaxed, at ease, alert, clear, clearly reflecting whatever appears, not garishly sparkling, but more toned down. Because your cognitions are not sticky with respect to their objects, they don't grasp at all their details, and thus your mind does not indulge itself in mental wandering. If you ever have the chance to be near a teacher, an accomplished teacher, or serve them, her or him, this is the thing to actually connect with, that the sort of the purpose of being close to the teacher is that it's actually really helpful to see and sort of feel what is it like that somebody is not distracted constantly like most of us are and is just totally peacefully there. Now what usually happens is you're so nervous around them that it's very hard to pick up on that because you've got to like do a job, you have to serve, or you have to, they're asking you questions and you're all, you know. But if you can, the best thing is like when you're not in the line of discussion and you're like to the side and you can watch. That's the best thing. You just watch them and they're just like peaceful. They're not fidgeting. They're not like thinking about the past or the future. It's really profound to experience them. At all times, your mind should be stable like Mount Meru, clear like a mirror, reflecting everything. Don't be excited or inquisitively looking about everywhere. If you focus too minutely on details, your mind will spin and become overwhelmed with thoughts. Be subdued and just let all of them pass through your mind without grasping. Even if you walk down a busy street and a dancing boy should happen to be performing on the side of the road, just let him pass, his image pass through your awareness without letting your attention become glued. To be able to always maintain your mental composure is a sign of shamatha. There are three boons. What a great word, boons. You receive bliss, clarity, and non-conceptuality. So here they're positives. These are the noms. Rinpoche says these are, he said it has a negative slant on them, but they can go both ways. Rinpoche, you know, calls them noms in a sort of negative way.
Right.
Depending
both.
On which.
Both.
It can be both. Things can, it can go both ways, right?
It depends on what you do with.
Let's see. You can have heightened vision, heightened hearing, extrasensory perception, and even extra physical powers. That would be cool. There are the 10 signs of single-minded concentration that occur, and so forth. And those are, there's this standard list of 10 signs, which is like smoke, fireflies, a haze, and I don't know that I've ever read the full list. They always like list a few and so forth. But
those some of the same things that come up in the Bardo state?
Yeah, they are as you're passing out, yeah. And any of these may happen when your quiescence is flawless, and such things will develop in your mind stream. These are the foundation that will give rise to all benefits, such as penetrative insight. So whatever you do, whether you're sick, happy or sad, no matter what, don't be attached or compulsively attracted to whatever occurs in your experience. being confident that they have no essence at all. Don't indulge yourself with any thoughts of happiness or depression. If you're obsessed with these experiences, they will only serve as a root for samsara, making you circle into one of the three realms. These alone cannot liberate you from samsara. And even outsiders have these accomplishments. You don't even have to be a Buddhist to experience these things. So, geez. So clearly they're of no benefit to them. Let's see. All these special powers are a side product of single-minded concentration, shamatha. Let's skip that. The boon of bliss, clarity, and non-conceptuality are the fields from which the crop of penetrative insight into their voidness arises. To be obsessed with any of them, not realizing their emptiness, leads to a birth in samsara. Being born as a god of desire realm comes from attachment to the boon of bliss, in the form realm from clarity, and in the formless realm from compulsive desire for emptiness or bareness, nakedness. In short, if you're obsessed with and attached to whatever experience insights you have, you will destroy them. Be detached from them and remain steady in a non-compulsive state. So pretend that you don't care about them, then they're like, happening. With enthusiastic perseverance, pull yourself out of laziness. If you meditate while increasing your tolerance for hardships, you will reap benefits beyond all imagination. Be like Jetson Milarepa, meditated in high mountain caves for 12 years, eating only nettles. Don't give up if your food runs out or if your bed is too hard. Like lifting yourself up out of a box, uplift yourself from making excuses for not practicing. With perseverance, you will reach enlightenment. Therefore, you must study about this with a teacher, as both the guru and disciple must not make any mistakes about these boons. Comprehension of the details of the instruction and the insights and the way to progress. Make sure to recognize and know them with certainty. The main thing is not to have any compulsive attraction to sensory objects and to have uncontrived admiration and loving respect for your guru. This thing about compulsive attraction to sensory objects, in other places they talk about as you progress and achieve some experiences of mental quiescence, certain unusual experiences get magnified. Certain former propensities can become magnified. Compulsion for food or other activities can arise sort of unexpectedly. Cultivate the bodhicitta. To all sentient beings, always keep your mindfulness in check and have no mental wandering. Don't make any plans, any short-term, only make short-term plans as if you had no time, and execute them straight up and down like a bellows. I don't know what that means particularly, but don't come under the sway of polite affectations or the eight worldly feelings. Right, the worst thing is like to get wooed in by praise and blame, particularly praise that you get sucked in by, if you've ever been unlucky to have that happen to you, and then you can just waste huge amounts of energy. The root of all attainments is guru devotion and faith and her instructions. This combined with bodhicitta will propel you on to become a Buddha. As death can come at any moment, don't make any long-term fanciful plans, such as next year I should build a house and then take a spouse. This room will be the nursery, I'll have three children, the furniture will be walnut. Live in the walnut. Live in the present moment. I don't know. I think that's a little bit of a radio. That's another radio. Whatever you set out to do, such a 7-day retreat, carry it through to completion. If you give up in the middle of your goals, it'll set up a negative pattern. Don't come under the influence of polite affectations, such as flattering or favors, trying to save face. Be like Milarepa, no servants or masters to worry about. Cast off your bondage to the worldly feelings of being pleased and so forth. This is very important. If you practice flawlessly like this, you will progress. Therefore, do it. Wow. Right along. So now we get into the looking in this and the seeing, the looking and the different exercises for Vipassana, the very culmination. Oh, this is where it gets really exciting. So let's go into Vipassana, looking at the settled, so it begins with looking, actually flip through just a minute. So looking at the settled mind, next page, looking at the moving mind, i.e. the thinking mind, i.e. my mind. Then thirdly, looking at the mind reflecting appearances is number three. So looking at experience of sense objects, looking at the mind in relation to the body. How do the two connect is the fourth one. Fifth one is looking at the settled and the moving minds together. And then we have a series of recognitions. Recognizing the nature of the settled mind. Recognizing the nature of the moving or thinking mind. Recognizing the nature of the mind reflecting appearances and the mind in relation to the body. So first you go through a series. There's usually like six of each. There's six looking at the settled mind, looking at the moving mind, looking at sense objects, looking at mind and body, looking at mind, moving and settled mind together. And then there's seeing them. So the key is to try to figure out what's the difference between looking and seeing. Right? And think of that as you go through it. Recognizing the nature. So there's looking and there's recognizing. So it's like, it's a little bit like when you go to, let's say, meet a friend at Grand Central, right? And you haven't met the friend in a while, a few years. But, you know, if you're friends, you know what your friend looks like. They may have changed a little bit, but. So you're looking out over the sea of people going through Central, Grand Central, you know. You're looking. And then you see your friend. It's a little bit like that, right? Looking is scanning, and then seeing, you've identified, you recognize.
Is that awareness and mindfulness? Sounds like it.
I don't think so.
No?
But it also seems like when Rinpoche talked about it in terms of Dharma art, the metaphor was more like you were talking about if you're just looking and then you see it, but Dharma art used to talk about you look at something, and then you stay with it, and you see something which is the presence. Which, in this case, it seems like you're actually not looking to try to find it, but you're looking at something, and then you go deeper into its nature.
I think same thing. You know, when I said you're looking at Grand Central, that's the thing. And then you see the nature. But anyone else?
Well, I mean, I also go with what John's saying in terms of the it's the same object, but different, slightly different relationship. But on the other hand, I think that, you know, there's...
Well, certainly with the mind, you know, you're looking at the mind and then you're seeing the mind. So as you said, it's there's some deeper, some different experience
mm-hmm.
of the same object.
Right.
But I'm saying it's not that different than that experience of you know, maybe it's easier if you say that I'm looking for my friend as opposed to me saying, okay, you're looking at all these people, but you're looking for your friend and then you're seeing your friend.
And of course there's the time when you flipped around and you go with seeing and
That's the other thing is that then he changes the wording. He says first you have to see and then you look.
Right. Which also makes sense in a different way.
You can explain anything.
Yeah.
Go on.
Okay.
Or is it more of your relationship changes?
Yeah.
The situation has to change.
Oh,
the way you relate.
Yeah, the thing doesn't change at all.
But because you relate to it differently, it is now different. Because it's
yeah.
But it's not like you're looking at something and then you find it. It's the way you relate to it, and
yeah.
therefore it changes as you change to it.
Yeah. We could do a demonstration. If you would come up here with your back towards everybody, don't let them see the front part of your shirt.
Okay.
Yeah, hold the book like that. Okay, yeah, come here so they can all see it, and turn around so they can see, but hold the book in front.
All right.
Okay, ready? See the shift in your mind as it goes from looking to seeing. Yeah, whenever you're ready. Really? Did you recognize it immediately?
He would say, look at red, and then see the redness of red. So it'd be more like, we look at the cat, and then stay with it, and then see the essence of that.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. So, but it happens in that moment. So if he had stood there the whole time, you would have already experienced the shift because you've been looking at the cat the whole time. So when you first see the cat, then you go through a moment of you're looking at that and then you see it.
Yes.
But both of them are with the same object, yes, is what you're saying. I agree. Right?
It's a wolf.
It's not a cat.
Maybe it'd be cooler.
I didn't see it. I'm still looking. I'm still looking. I didn't look properly. That's a cool t-shirt. Thank you, Norm. Second main topic is penetrative insight meditation, i.e. Vipassana. You should sit in the essential bodily posture as before. And at this point, the way of looking is extremely important. Your eyes should not be blinking, wavering to and fro, or changing focus, but should be staring intensely with sharp focus directly ahead and slightly upwards. It's a little bit difficult to do. So particularly for those of us that have been sitting with our eyes downward cast for many, many, many years, going upwards even to the horizon is difficult to do without becoming discursive or energy dispersing. So, you know, basically be an honest gauge in your own experience, and when you want to practice, try to practice Vipassana. First, stabilize. Spend a lot of your session stabilizing and settling. And then when you're ready, raise your gaze up. Maybe, you know, initially it's 45, maybe then bring it up below the horizon. You know, higher than usual. And then when you're relaxed there, and you're, you know, because you're seeing more space, light, and it can lead to more distraction. And then go to the horizon, and then as you're stable, they gradually come up even a little bit more. It's a little bit unsettling, I think, at first. Slightly upwards of the space before you. In shamatha, your mind has become like a clear mirror. With penetrative insight, you examine, with Vipassana, you examine the nature of this mirror and the images in it, right? So we're examining the nature of the mind that has been identified. Basically, the mind has been heightened through shamatha. Through shamatha, we've sort of clarified the mind. The idea of, you know, the thoughts settling and the mud settling so that we have the nature of the mind as being this clear, aware thing, sort of, right? And so then with Vipassana, we're looking into that clarity and that awareness that has those two qualities. It's clear, reflective, and it's knowing. So when we say the mind is clear and aware, which is the traditional definition of mind in the Tibetan logic tradition, clear and aware. Clear means it reflects everything impartially. Whatever comes in front of it is described as reflecting, meaning it creates its aspect in the mind, right? You can't like selectively not see something that's in front of you. But everything that appears in front of your vision, appears in your mind, sounds, touch, whatever, is all reflected in your mind. And there's a knowing, there's an understanding, that bare sense of understanding of what's going on, of experience, that self-awareness, you know you're experiencing. So the clarity is the mindfulness, developed from the mindfulness, and then the awareness is the shesha, the knowing. So then with Vipassana, we're examining the nature of the mind and the images in it, which you know, are they different from the mind or not, right? The way of looking is slightly different for these two, i.e. the mind as the mirror and the images in that. The way of looking is slightly different for these two, meaning in shamatha the way of looking is different from the way of looking at vipassana. Sorry about that. In shamatha, your eyes should be looking straightforward, relaxed, and in focus. For vipassana, look more intensely and slightly upwards. This uplifts and sharpens the mind. So your mind comes to a point. The difference is like between your arm when it is at ease and when it is flexed. It's an interesting image, right? When your arm is at ease and when your arm is flexed. There's a heightened tension in your arm, right? When it's flexed.
Oh, flexed?
Flex is this. So it's at ease is this, you're right. This is heightened tension. You can explain anything, right? Place your mind in a faultlessly settled state of equipoise in which it is natural at its own level, uncontrived, unselfconsciously, not anxiously caring, and then make it slightly more intense so that it's clear and vivid, and have your mindfulness keep an ever-present check so that you have no mental wandering. So it's key that you're able to figure out how to do this. You take your mind, you sort of settle your mind, and you're quite aware, you're quite present. You're vividly present, but then you're intensifying it. So what does that mean? How do you do that? What's one way of intensifying the clarity of your awareness of your present mindfulness? Using senses? What's like a negative way of doing it? Getting angry, yeah. Or like paranoia, right? Like, you know, you hear something that you're unfamiliar with, and immediately it's like, you know, your radar goes up, right? Or somebody says something that makes you mad, and you're like, your shields go up, right? Your Klingon shields or whatever. Have your mindfulness keep an ever-present check so that you have no mental wandering at the same time. Now look scrupulously at the nature of your mind when it is in full, perfect shamatha. By nature, does it have a color, form, a shape? Does it have an arising, ceasing, enduring, or not? Is it outside? Inside? Where is it settled? Now when we say the mind, do we mean the thoughts or the watcher when we're looking for the mind?
Watching the
what?
That's the question to ponder.
Yeah, looking at the thoughts or the watcher?
At this point, when we say, by scrupulously looking at the nature of your mind when it's in quiescence, by nature, does it have a color, a form, a shape?
I think it's either one. Yeah,
can you talk together again?
I think we're agreeing.
Yes.
Because it says look at the settled state.
Yes, I think this one is starting with the settled state.
But you're looking at this kind of clear, placid, settled, whatever it is.
From the watcher.
The watcher is looking at it, although that's implicit, not explicit. But it's not the watcher, it's kind of the object of the settled state. I think maybe that's what you're exactly saying.
Same thing. Yeah, certainly, of those two things you presented, it's neither.
Because then you said the thoughts, but those would be.
What's the third option? I said, is it the thoughts or is it the watcher? What's the third option?
Both. Neither of those.
Both or neither.
Both and neither, right? God.
Yeah,
Both and neither.
Neither of those.
Yeah.
Or dog.
Well,
it's a dog.
Well, it's just that, I mean, as you say, the notion of being clear and aware, you know, if that's the nature of the mind. The question is, what is it like to experience that? You know, right? So the notion is you're looking at that nature of it, which is not necessarily an observer, nor is it a thing or a thought.
So what if it's not the the watcher or the thinker, then what might it be?
Bare awareness.
Bare awareness.
I'm asking
about
the thoughts.
Just the thoughts themselves.
That's what
I said. It's not the thoughts.
Right?
If it's not the thoughts and it's not the watcher, then what might it be?
What's the mirror or the ocean?
The mirror, right?
The thing on which the thoughts would ripple, but they aren't ripple.
And so then we're separating the watcher from the mind as well, right?
Yeah.
And so where can you do, you know, this is, I think, what the practice is saying is like, can you identify this mind as different from those two things, the thinking and the watching? Is there this projection of there being a mind?
Yes, but we typically have a projection of there being a mind.
Right.
Yes.
So that's sort of giving away the answer, which he does, the author does, is that we have a projection of there being a mind, a mirror. That the mirror is somewhere, that there is a mirror, and that it's somewhere.
It's just a metaphor, and that too has to be taken lightly, you know, taken with a grain of salt.
But the metaphor is for something that we mentally project, that we have, we project the sense that our mind is somewhere.
Yeah, because we're thing-oriented.
Right.
So we're looking for, yeah, we
something exists that has to.
Right. So this is, I mean, I found this very personally confusing for many years. It's like when they do these exercises of looking at your mind, it seemed like trite and like they weren't really saying to do that, but they were saying to see that there is no mind. And they're actually saying to see that we project a sense of there being a mind. So where is your mind?
Whatever is the.
So when you're sitting here right now, where does it feel like your mind is, your awareness is? You said the clear, open awareness. Here, right? I mean, most of us, it's here. I think very few people have it in their feet. Or
well, the thing is that we obviously mix our senses with the notion of mind.
Yeah. Most of our senses are here. And so somehow our brain sort of thinks of itself as being centered there, right? So if it has a location, it has a shape and a size. So look and see where it's located and what shape and size it is, right? So that's the homework.
Basically, it's a projection, then it could be anything.
Exactly.
And it changes based on what you're thinking about.
Oh, shit.
It is.
The whole point is you give away all the answers and then the issue is whether anyone has the patience to actually do it.
Right,
because
right.
If you don't do it.
If you don't do it, it doesn't go anywhere. It's all highfalutin dharma jogging. Right? Right, so the idea is that we all have a projection of there being a mind, a mental projection of the mind being in a place with a shape and a size. They say color too. I mean, do you find a color to your mind?
Sometimes. It also depends on how you define color. I mean, it's just like one word can mean many things to people.
Yes, yeah. So what are the options?
For me, I use the language of color, but that's for my own sort of frame of reference.
Yeah.
And to me, that means it then. Helps color the frame of reference that's incoming. So you can mix that with sometimes you might be able to use that around the word emotion.
Yeah, feeling tone. It's like a feeling tone, right? So feeling tone and color maybe are being mixed together, so to speak.
I mean, almost always we're going to tend towards
We're over time,
falling back to some kind of sensory experience. That's one of the challenges. Is that we tend to be, we're so habituated to body experience.
Yeah. And so I think the whole technique of Mahamudra meditation is saying that unless you can actually see the source, like actually identify the source of confusion, ignorance, which is the belief in a self, and I think we all acknowledge and experience that we've really identified the self in our awareness. So if you can actually find where you're holding that sense of self, then you can actually work on dissolving it. You know, and so the highfalutin Dharma jargon of saying, oh, you know, it's empty, it doesn't exist, you know, it doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't lead to anything.
How can you be aware of something?
How can you be aware of something?
Something's working to be aware of something. Has to exist and function for you to be aware. So
where's that functioning happening?
Right, you extrapolate that has to be somewhere and have a color or a shape, but those are from the physical realm. But
yeah.
You know for sure, okay, if I'm being aware, then or not aware, then there's something lurking, bare bones, and so therefore, yeah. Quandary.
And see if it shifts, see if it changes when you're out and about in different experiences. See if that sense of your mind, your awareness changes. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
There's actually a lot of assumption. I mean, it says be aware and be mindful, and it never says, like, how can you be aware and mindful?
Well, I think what you're getting at is that in some sense, this practice of shamatha almost concretizes the sense of self in your mind.
Yeah.
It like enhances it.
They never
and,
question that.
And if you don't do the insight, that can actually be a problem. You can like enhance the sense of self. But in some ways, it makes the insight
easier.
Do you think
so? I mean, because I think there's some aspects of shamatha that I think shift. Instead of, I mean, you're saying that it sort of solidifies it, but I think there's a ways in which shamatha also undermines it.
In what
ways? I don't think we should always give shamatha a bad rap.
Oh, no.
I think it
not at all.
It has
I
value
agree.
In terms of
yeah.
Just even by, you know, the whole letting go and...
But it seems that shamatha is pretty much dualistic, whereas awareness, if you're not into awareness, dissolves that.
But what about like shamatha on the nature?
Sorry?
Shamatha using the nature of the mind as its object.
You still have subject object. Whereas in non-dual awareness, there's no subject object.
By definition.
Yeah.
Dual awareness, you have dualistic, not.
But on the other hand, still, even if you're using a non-existent thing as an object, it gets.
It can loosen
up the duality of it, because you can't. You know.
Well, if you do shamatha with, like in the context, you know, it's like we do shamatha within this context. We're always talking about egolessness and this and that, right? So you know, so there is a sense of investigation that goes on in shamatha, of like feeling that the spaciousness that occurs in shamatha is sort of challenging in not an active way, but in a sort of passive way, your sense of cohesiveness of a self,
mm-hmm.
Right? So it's loosening up that solidified sense of self. So yes, it totally can be helpful. On the other hand, it could be like you're creating like a more skillful sense of self. Myself is now so sophisticated that I'm able to maintain a ununified sense of self. I don't know. Anyway.
It can be used in different ways.
It can
be misused. Yeah.
And if you don't get to that point, I'm calmer, I can focus better, I'm not as stressed, I'm a better person now.
Yeah, right. That's actually the kind of mainstream thing that's going on, that people are a little...
Yeah, even non-Buddhists experience that.
Incidentally, research for gain enlightenment.
No, that's right. Anyway, so look at your mind. See if you can find your mind. Where is it? What's its shape and size and color?
How much does it cost?
By this marriage, may all obtain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. by the confidence of the golden sun of the Pleiades, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon system bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled.
May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.
Okay, so I believe next week these rooms are not available for us. Is that right?
Yeah.
So we'll meet at Neil's place. If you have a cushion and you can bring it, like a meditation cushion, do that. I have a bunch and I have a car, so I'll bring that. No, and I'll circulate the address.
Same time?
Yes, same time.
Okay. Do you think you're half an hour before?
Oh, let's try to do like the Shamat, the Mahamudra sitting beforehand together. I suspect we may start later than 7 though, given the change. It's closer for me, yeah, which is really helpful. So it's upper west side. It's like at 95th or something. I'm sorry, Peter?
This one's not specific. This is like a class more than a day.
Yeah, this is a class.
But it's the last class, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Is that the last class?
Yeah.
We don't know yet.
Yeah, I mean, we should be able to get through the rest of it. It depends if we want to do more or drag it out or something. Maybe we have one more that's then we can have the last class just relaxed. So we don't have to try to do both the beer and the food and all this material next time. So how about that? Okay. Yeah, we have to have one so you can be there the next week. He's on Riverside Drive. At the 78th Street. So I'll circulate that.